I'm Laura Palmer, host of Island Crime. Season 6, Sweethearts, is the story of three teenage girls who were all murdered in Victoria, Canada, within about 12 months.
So she was scared. Something out there scared her.
You've just created the playground where predators can really thrive.
She was a 16-year-old girl. She was a sweetheart.
Listen to Sweethearts at frequencypodcastnetwork.com or wherever you get podcasts.
Find your frequency.
This story starts with a polar bear, and it ends in a courtroom in Canada's north. And in between, it touches on a lot of the things that are integral to our identity. Up north, the polar bear is loved and feared. They are a wonder of nature, a symbol of climate change. But they are also to the Inuit food and clothing and a revenue stream. To scientists and nature lovers, the bears are a species at risk, and their declining population serves as a warning bell. That is, if the population is actually declining, because the polar bear is also, to people who live with them, a growing threat, a danger to families and children, and to the small towns that used to live in peace, mostly undisturbed by bears hunting on the ice around them. So in the middle of all this is a bear and a gun and a bylaw, and Inuit people who live among the bears, and scientists who mean well, maybe, but when push comes to shove, don't know anything about the North. So yeah, it's a story about a bear. But when our guest today went north to tell it, he found a lot more than that. I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings, and this is The Big Story. Our good friend, Aaron Hutchins, is a writer at Maclean's who goes to a lot of weird places. And this time, he went north.
Yeah, right. I got my certificate for being north of the Arctic Circle.
Describe for me the scene that starts this story and where it all sprung from.
Last year, I read about a young man in his early 30s from Arviat, Nunavut, which is just north of Churchill, Manitoba. And he was out with his kids, his daughters, on an island nearby when a bear kind of snuck up on them. His rifle was back in the boat. And to save his daughters, he put himself between his daughters and the bear, ordered them back to the boat so they could radio for help. And he was mauled. He was killed. Then a couple weeks later, I read a second story in this town called Nauyat, which is way, way up kind of the northwestern tip of the Hudson Bay. And there was a couple of guys who went on a hunting trip and their boat broke down. They got stranded. The next morning, they were having tea as they're trying to figure out kind of next steps when a mother bear and her cub snuck up on the tent. And the one thing you don't do around a bear is panic. And this one man, Daryl Kalanak, was sleeping. He heard screams. One of his friends was being attacked. Man. He got out of the tent and ran. His friend took the rifle, shot the bear before it jammed after one shot. One shot wasn't enough to take down the bear. And as he went for his other rifle, Daryl died from the bear. So there were two deaths in the span of a couple months up in Nunavut. And I wanted to see what really was happening up there with the danger being posed by polar bears up there. But even I couldn't have predicted what would have taken place inside this courtroom in early March.
Tell me about the incident that led to the courtroom. Who was facing charges and what did they do or not do?
So the guy who died on the hunting trip, he was from Nauyat, Daryl Kalanak. And after he was killed, they had to wait for days until Coast Guard found the guy, the hunters who wouldn't leave his body there. They brought it back to town where he was buried. The town's engraver is broken, so he actually is in an unmarked grave in this hill overlooking Nauyat next to his dad's grave. And less than 2 weeks after they'd buried him, another polar bear kind of arrived on the outskirts of town. And this is not uncommon up in the north where bears will kind of come through town. It is terrifying. Everyone will agree on that, but it is common. And the emotions are really raw. Two Inuit had died recently, one of their own, and a bear was in the outskirts of town. It was about an hour before sunset. Someone saw the bear. They went on the CB radio, which hunters keep on them all the time, and they said, there's a bear. Everyone just be aware.
What do they usually do when that call goes out?
There's a wildlife conservation officer whose job is to essentially scare the bear away, because the Wildlife Act says you shouldn't kill a bear unless it's out of self-defense or if you have a hunting tag. Now, these towns don't have nearly as many hunting tags as required, the locals would say. The conservation officer would be a person who'd go out there with a rifle or bear bangers, which is something to kind of scare the bear, and you'd shoot the rifle in the air or set off the bear bangers in hopes of scaring the bear away.
Right.
The locals will say that the bears will come back hours later, a couple days later, but the bears don't get scared away for good. So as the conservation officer was en route to scare the bear away, an elder, very well-respected hunter, went on the airwaves and said, somebody kill that bear before it kills one of us again. And right then you have, this is not uncommon, every hunter, every friend of Daryl gets in their truck, on their snowmobile, on their ATV, and heads straight for the shore with their rifles, hoping to kill that bear. And someone killed the bear. And normally it could just end right there. The bear is dead. The town is safe for now. But in this case, there was still the matter of whether you're allowed to kill a bear. Bears are not endangered species, but they're vulnerable. And what happened was it took 3 months, but then a very well-respected hunter and local guide, Laurent Kringayark, he got a ticket for $230 for breaking the Wildlife Act for illegal harvesting of a wildlife animal, killing a bear. These people are by no means rich up there, but he could afford $230.
Yeah.
He's not paying it. He says, I'm not going to pay this. He takes a photo, puts it up on his Facebook page, says, I got this ticket, written in English, by the way, which is not his mother tongue, about killing a bear, but I feel so sorry for the Inuit and the locals here that I'm going to go to court instead. And I traveled up to the Arctic Circle to be there for that day in court.
Tell me the contradiction around polar bears that is kind of at the heart of everything in your story.
Yeah, this is the one thing that I think a lot of folks like myself that I really don't know about the North is when you read stories about the North, you hear about polar bears' population in decline. You know about their iconic status. They're on the Toonie. They're in Coke commercials. There's all these, you know, memes that show bears are swimming in water because there's no ice, that they're struggling, that they're starving. And about 25,000 polar bears is the current estimate of population of bears around the world. So when you ask scientists, they'll say one of the polar bear subpopulations is growing, but four are in decline. The Inuit will say that nine subpopulations are growing of the 13, and not a single one is in decline. And when you get to the harvesting quota, whether it's for teaching someone how to hunt for traditional reasons, whether it's for food, whether it's for taking a rich tourist who's going to pay a good amount of money to, you know, shoot a bear, the board that dictates the numbers each community gets takes into consideration both scientific and traditional knowledge. And you can imagine if these towns feel like they're being overrun with bears that are not only endangering themselves, but endangering their livelihood, they aren't especially pleased when a quota takes into consideration scientific results that they completely disagree with.
What is the relationship like between the scientists who study the bears and the Inuit who live in these towns? Because they interact, right?
They do, yeah. And for some part, the Inuit are incredibly generous people. They're very nice. The scientists, too, are all very, like, this is their life's work. They're happy to tell about their results. But there are some factors that make this relationship a bit more political than I'm sure either side would want. And by that, I mean, it's not just the results that they disagree with, but it's also their methods. The scientists do what any good scientist would do. They find data, they find numbers, they shoot them with a tranquilizer gun, go down, measure their body fat, blood, take a tooth sample out. They will tattoo their lips. They can track these bears over the long term to see how they're doing, which ones are surviving, which ones they see again.
Right.
And they can make really strong predictions based on what their results say. The Inuit aren't especially pleased, not only with the results, but also their methods. One common theme was that the scientists, they're from Alberta, Manitoba. They're not from the North. They come up for a week or two, take some results. They go back south. They say populations are in decline, but they don't see the bears that they see. They're not on the land. They're not the ones seeing the bears walk through town all the time. They don't see what it's really like. But it's also more than that. One of the challenges for writing the story when I was in Nowyat is I soon learned is that elders taught locals that you don't talk about polar bears. And that was a common thing I heard. We don't talk about polar bears.
Like not at all?
Rarely. You never say anything bad about polar bears. And the reason is quite simply, polar bears are listening. There was an anthropologist who was living in Arvik who told me a story when she went out she went on the land with some elders and hunters. And there was a polar bear, you know, not so far away, kind of minding his own business. And the young man threw a stone at the polar bear to get to go away.
Right.
Hit the polar bear in the head. Polar bear went away. A couple hours later, that guy had a massive headache. And the elder said to him, what do you expect? You threw the rock at the bear's head. Of course he's going to give you a headache. This is the reverence that they have for these creatures. So you can imagine if the Inuit are not pleased with a local throwing rocks at someone's head, You can imagine how they feel about someone tranquilizing a bear, taking their teeth out, taking blood samples, making them all groggy, and then saying, okay, bear, on your way. Now, the scientists, they understand this, but they can't do much about it, and to some degree.
Well, you have to tag them if you're going to track them.
If you're going to track them. So they say that all of the studies they have done have not proven that anything they're doing is to any detriment to bears or bear populations. But it's tough to explain that to Inuit who have their beliefs rooted in history of how you should treat these creatures.
Well, there's one quote from the story you wrote that stands out to me. It's just one of the people you talk to looks at them and says, they don't know anything about the North.
Yeah. That's a common thing. This gentleman, Eli Mickey Maliki, he's a very well-respected hunter. He's a teacher at the high school. He teaches culture at the high school. And he was telling me the same things. He took out, you know, an iPad and showed me Google Maps and showed me Nauyad and Igloolik, which is just further north up along the Fox Basin. And he said, you know, generations ago, there was just small village after village where people lived. Now people don't live there anymore. They live in bigger communities like Nauyad or Igloolik.
Right.
Nauyad's, 1,100 people, so it's not big, but it's, people don't live out on the land anymore. And he shows all this land that's just empty now. And he's like, when people go out hunting, that's where the bears are. The bears are growing in population out there, but the scientists don't go there and they don't see this. And then when we go out there, we see tons and our lives are at risk because eventually, depending on when they're looking for food, these bears, they will inevitably come through town.
How sensitive are the scientists who come up there and obviously probably try their best to understand the deep relationship that's kind of at play here? How sensitive are they to the fact that they might not be seeing what happens here year round and those numbers might be wrong?
I don't make the scientists look out to be bad guys because they're doing great work and they are very cognizant of the Inuit and their beliefs even more so than I am. When they try to prove their numbers, they have the data and they show their methods. It's all publicly available to some degree. Mm-hmm. When the Inuit ask them, how do you get to these results? They'll say, this is how I did it, but it's all there.
Yeah.
And there's a sense of frustration that with the Inuit, their numbers with traditional knowledge, it's not rooted in the same type of science. One scientist told me, if I ask them a question, how they came to this number, it's considered an insult to them. It's considered rude. He's been called a racist for even asking, how did you get these numbers? They are very sympathetic to the Inuit's plight. They are not denying that they're seeing more bears come through town. They would believe that's actually more a result of maybe climate change and with less ice, the bears have to stay in town longer. And a lot of the scientists I talk to are not even anti-harvest. They believe in harvesting. And they're not saying, let's harvest fewer bears, because that's outside of their purview. They're just saying, these are the numbers. We give them to the board, governments or whatnot, and they make the decision. We're just saying what the numbers are. Every single scientist I spoke to said it is a very delicate situation, to say the least.
How are relationships and incidents between the Inuit and the bears governed by regulations?
So in this case, if there's an incident, the wildlife conservation officer would do his investigation, and then he would report to a superior if need be, and it would go up to the Department of Environment, and that body would make a decision whether it was, in this case, was a defense kill. Because if it's a defense kill, then there's no ticket. It would take off from your quota for that town's quota from the year. And if the town had exercised its quota already, it would take one off the next year's quota. So losing one of your bears you can kill for money, for food, for whatever, for self-defense is something that is also a testy issue. But it's the conservation officer in the one in town is the one who is the kind of the investigator in this. And also, as we learned in court, he's the prosecutor as well.
So tell me about this guy. Who is he?
There is one lone conservation officer in Nauyad. His name is Peter Lucy Papatsi. He is not from Nauyad, but he is an Inuk. And he is a very strong, stoic, and also very silent man. And what I found most interesting was Laurent Kringayark, the hunter who was given the ticket for allegedly killing the polar bear. He wanted this case heard, had a summons ticket, said, show up, this day at 9:30 a.m., and his case wasn't even on the docket. So he went to the RCMP officer, who asked the lawyer, who asked the clerk, who asked the judge, and eventually said, okay, we can get this on. And then in that case, they had to go across the street, it's a very small town, find Peter Lucy Papatsi, say, hey, there's the traveling Crown prosecutor. And he says, I don't do Wildlife Act. That's outside of, I do all these, it was mostly domestic assaults is what I saw in court that day. And it was all very, very quick cases. But in this case, Peter Lucy is the one who was technically the enforcement officer and the prosecutor for this case. Mm. He gave the ticket 3 months after the bear was killed.
Right.
So it had taken a while to do it. And this is a small town where people know things pretty quickly. There was a broken window at my hotel. I knew who it was within 45 seconds because you go through town and people say, oh, don't tell anyone, but it was so-and-so.
Right.
Like, it's a small town. Yeah, people may not put their names behind it, but people will let you know what happened. So shows up in court. And then Gary Wool is the Crown prosecutor for every case up to this day. He's the lone one. He is a Caucasian originally from Northwest Territories. And he says, Your Honor, Mr. Papazzi is going to be the prosecutor for this case. Mr. Kringayark is someone who was charged with for killing a polar bear, allegedly. And I'd like to say a few words as a friend of the court first. And the judge agrees. He says, but by the way, I don't know polar bear law that well. And he says, Your Honor, this will resolve itself in front of the court today. And then he stands up, and for every court case that day, it takes 30 seconds for them to, like, you know, defer or pass on to something. He stands up, and he gives his speech, and he says, Your Honor, this is a story of a polar bear, which is not something you're going to see in Nunavut or Northwest Territories. And Peter Lucy Papazzi gave Mr. Kringayark and another gentleman a ticket for the killing of two bears. And then the mood switched, and he said, it's been the news recently. Everyone heard the testimony of Ms. Wilson-Raybould and the importance of the independence of the Attorney General and the importance of the independence of prosecutors, which is the cornerstone of our justice system.
Interesting.
And in that moment, the judge, who is from Guelph originally, sits up in her chair and she goes, oh my, because then she realized that something is happening. And Gary Wool, the friend of the court, normally Crown prosecutor, starts talking about the importance of the independence of the prosecutors and the importance of the justice system and how Mr. Papazzi has to wear two hats. He's trying to be enforcement officer. He's trying to be the prosecutor. But whenever a prosecutor should decide how a matter goes forward, and no one should decide how a matter goes forward except for the prosecutor. Hmm. And Peter Lucy is sitting still and stoic the entire time, does not move. And then Gary switches to reconciliation. He talks about himself being a Kalanat, a white person, and how when he started learning from elders up north, his wife is Dene, him being a Kalanat, a white guy, you often ask people why. It's what we do in university. It's what we do in college. You say, why is this? Why is that? And he says, up in the north, things are a bit different. You don't ask an elder why in the moment. You might ask about some things later on to learn from them because elders have a lot to teach us. But if an elder says, go kill that bear before it kills one of us, you don't ask why. You go do it because that elder has knowledge about why something should happen.
Right.
And sometimes that tradition goes up against territorial law. And that is a very difficult bridge to gap for someone like Mr. Papazzi, let's say, who is an Inuk who learned from the elders, learned from hunting on the land, and also has to enforce Her Majesty's law. Gary Wool, friend of the court, talks a bit more about reconciliation. He says, you know, there's some opportunities we have to find a middle ground to reconciliation. And this could be one of those times. And with that, he turns it over to Mr. Papazzi, the conservation officer, who stands up and says, Your Honor, I'd like, instead of giving Mr. Kringayark a $200 fine, I'd like to issue a verbal warning and the tickets will be stayed, effectively withdrawn. Hmm. Talks for no more than 25 seconds. And the judge looks over at, you know, the defense, Mr. Kringayark, and she says, I assume this is, you know, okay with your clients to have these tickets just gone. And through the lawyer, Kringayark makes it known that he understands what's happening here. He's going to respect the outcome of today's proceedings, but he wants one thing on the record in the court, and that's that he did absolutely nothing wrong. And the lawyer, rather the judge, says, you know, I don't know if you guys are going to make a constitutional argument about whether who has the right to say how many polar bears you can kill or how, but we're not doing a constitutional argument at 3 o'clock and now yet with a judge from Guelph.
Yeah.
So with that, they kind of go sit down. It's this very powerful moment. It's so, so quiet in the courtroom. Everyone's paying attention. Laurent comes back and sits back next to me in the front row. Court adjourns for recess. This is all happening in English, by the way. They have translators, but it's all happening in English. And Laurent kind of looks over to me and he goes, is it over?
Huh.
And I'm sitting there like, incredibly powerful moment. I'm like, yeah, Laurent, it's over. And he goes, all right, I'm going fishing.
Yep.
It's minus 44 outside. He's like, I'm going fishing. So he heads off. And that was it for the case. He essentially nothing happened in terms of law. Tickets were issued, tickets were stayed. But through the Gary Wool's words, through Peter Lucy and Anouk, with one of the very, very, very few decent paying jobs for an Anouk, let alone in Now Yet. Yeah, he wouldn't prosecute one of his fellow Inuit hunters for essentially following what an elder said to do. I think what the case was about was someone standing up for the Inuit. And I remember Laurent told me, he said, I'm going to court to see if any actual Inuit would point the finger at me in court to say what I did was wrong or that I did it and that I should pay a fine because what I did was against the law. And it was a bit more than that. And I think a lot of the local hunters especially were paying close attention to it. There was one elder who, you know, told me he paid attention to the court case and he said, listen, you know, when I grew up, the bears were our food. Now we're their food. Times have changed. And this was a time when Laurent, who was accused of killing a polar bear, said, things have to change, not next year, now, because if they don't, someone else is going to die from a polar bear. And it's going to keep on happening until someone stands up for our rights to shoot them whenever they come near town.
So much of this is about bigger themes of reconciliation and conservation and all of that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But it all comes back to an animal that's part of Canadian mythology.
Yeah. It's an animal that, for better or worse, represents climate change and all the polarizing opinions that might come with that.
But it also represents Canada.
Yeah.
And like it's the good and the bad of most our relationship with the wilderness.
Most Canadians have never seen a polar bear, which, by the way, are not cute and cuddly. They are terrifying creatures. Most Canadians have never seen a polar bear, and yet there is this incredible reverence for them. They're on our toonie. They are stunning creatures. They are the kings of the north. The majority of polar bears live in Canada. We have some sort of ownership over their survival, and we take that seriously. But one thing I've learned is through a lot of my readings of this is whenever I read a story about the polar bears and their plight, you often read about the scientist's point of view, which are incredibly valid and should be heard and should be listened to. Mm-hmm. But one thing you seldomly hear is the voices of the people who are not only those living closest to them, but also those who are most vulnerable to living near them. And that's a voice that is often less heard and should be amplified more.
What did you learn from those voices about polar bears that the rest of Canada doesn't really grasp?
There's an incredible amount of respect that should be given to the polar bears and fear, and we should be taking care of them. But while we listen to scientists who've dedicated their lives to the... But while we should listen to scientists who've dedicated their lives to studying these creatures, we should also listen to the people who are living next to them and seeing how their day-to-day lives are impacted. And not think of it solely as how are the polar bears doing, but also how are the people doing who must live next to these polar bears because this is where they're from.
Thanks, Aaron.
Anytime.
Aaron Hutchins of McLean's, world record holder for Big Story podcast appearances. That was The Big Story. For more from us, head on over to thebigstorypodcast.ca, scroll down to the bottom and hit search and type in Aaron Hutchins. You'll see what you get. You can also find us at frequencypodcastnetwork.com, on Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram at Frequency Pods, and on Twitter at TheBigStoryFPN if it's just us you want. As always, you can subscribe to this podcast for free wherever you get them. It doesn't matter which app because we are on them all. So hit up your favorite one and give us a rating and a review. I'm Jordan Heath-Rawlings. We'll talk tomorrow.